And welcome to episode 24 of Season to Taste. It's a Doctor Who podcast in which we watch one story from each season. It is as simple as that. And in the last episode, the randomizer selected season 22, Colin Baker's first-ish season, if you ignore the Twin Dilemma. And of that, we chose The Mark of the Rani. So, Matt, what did you think of Doctor Who and The Mark of the Master and the Rani?
It's quite fun, which is unusual for season 22. I don't think there's really many episodes which are much fun in that period. But it is quite fun. There's lots of enjoyable bits. Overall, I think it's a little bit weak, but there's lots of individual elements that make up for the overall weakness of it.
It starts off really promisingly. It has this really nice creation of this 19th century village.
Yeah.
And it's really well directed, and there's lots of interesting shots. And the BBC can do costume drama, and so they're actually, rather than trying to create some overlit alien world, you've actually got location filming. You've got an interestingly different location in the northeast, and so although the accents wander a little bit, it is nice to be somewhere where the Doctor doesn't normally go. And yeah, there's a real feeling of an interesting place and time. Then it's slightly undercut by cutting to the TARDIS and having the Doctor and Perry arguing again.
Well, I tend to think that there is no Colin Baker story which couldn't be improved by removing all of the TARDIS scenes.
One thing I did notice is it felt shorter, it felt a briefer argument in the TARDIS than a lot of other stories, and is almost acceptable because of the generally quite self-aware and funny line at the end where the Doctor and Perry asks as they're disappearing to the TARDIS, "So what is it you're doing there?" And the Doctor just says, "Argue mostly."
Yeah, I think you could just as happily have had the Doctor and Perry's involvement in the story begin with them landing on the slag heap as the bickering in the TARDIS beforehand.
You don't really need them in the TARDIS going, "Oh, there seems to be some kind of time machine in the area." That somewhat undermines any revelations about there being Time Lords there.
Yeah.
They even suggest it might be the Daleks, which is a way to excite your audience and then disappoint them, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Doctor's quite fun in this story, and he has a lot of nice moments, and he's quite gentle, which makes a pleasant change from some of the other Colin stories. But he still does have, and this is quite a Pip and Jane Baker thing, just ridiculous bits of dialogue. You know, his grammatical over-insistence on certain English usage, or just, you know, pompous turns of phrase. And the Master and the Rani are written the same way, as if that's how you write a Time Lord. They have pompous turns of phrase. And you can do that to some extent, but it goes a bit far in places.
Mm.
And it doesn't help that first scene with Perry where she's just repeating things back to him. You know, he's saying, "Oh, it's not working." And she's saying, "Not working." There's not exactly a lot of conversation going on, and then he's being patronising as well. Yeah. But once they get out the TARDIS and onto location, I think the fact of being on location as well mellows the performances. They're not trying to kind of big them up in a studio. It's a bit more natural.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think the Sixth Doctor in this story comes over much better in the location stuff than he does in the studio. Possibly because they've done it lots of times and they do multiple takes because it's single camera and it's a different way of making things. But I think everything on film, the direction on film, the look, the kind of sense of place, actually it almost looks like it was filmed in the 19th century. It's got a real, as you said at the start, it's got a real sense of this village that it's lived in, that people are dirty. It's almost that kind of George Lucas Star Wars type, this is a real place that we're visiting.
Mm.
And I think that's absolutely fantastic. Performances are really good when they're out on location. I think the studio stuff, in comparison, is very flat. Flatly directed, flatly lit, and much less interesting to look at. And I also think that the performances of some of the actors in studio maybe betrays the fact that they didn't really do lots of takes, or maybe it's just a different way of making it, which means that some of the performances seem a bit less charming in studio than they do on location.
I guess it's partly people trying to adapt to, in the studio environment, they're having to kind of create a world. So in the bathhouse, you know, you're in a three-sided set,
yeah,
with no roof. And if you're having a fight or whatever, you have to keep away from the flats and everything else. And on location, you're just in the place. And it, you know, it's something that is made up to look like a bathhouse. And you just act as you would. In the studio, you're kind of doing something extra to try and convince
Yeah.
Surrounded by artificiality, you know, staring at a gallery and a load of cameras. And it does have a different feeling to it. I think it does look, particularly that first bit in the bathhouse, there isn't that really sudden, jarring change from location to studio. It's quite gently done. But it's such a large set. It looks a bit like a set.
And it's just got this awful 80s issue that the whole thing's just flat lit. You don't get a sense that there's a candle walls. And the light's coming from a source. It just looks like the whole place is floodlit.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going inside a kind of 18th century building where there's one light source
and shadows.
There's a gloom and shadows. It is just, it's like our living room when all of the lights are on.
Yeah.
It has no atmosphere whatsoever.
And that's fine when it's the Rani's TARDIS, but not when it's the bathhouse.
But even more than that, I think it really took me out of the story because I was thinking the location filming's so good and it looks such a great sense of place. And I lost all of that the moment that they went into the bathhouse because I was like, oh, they haven't even bothered, there's no candle, there's just nothing. I don't get any sense of...
I hadn't noticed that
this is a real place.
I'd noticed the kind of bland, samey flooring and grey washed walls.
Yeah. It should be earth floor, you know, and of course they couldn't do it and the budget comes in, but I think one of the big issues with the look of Doctor Who in the 80s is that they just can't light the studios well enough, and it's a huge issue a lot of the time.
It's why, is it the Face of Evil where there's a big forest?
Yeah.
But it's done in a film studio.
Yeah.
And so although it's an artificial forest in a studio, it's lit for film and doesn't have that kind of just studio lighting that kind of 80s Who has.
And it's just so much more atmospheric because with film, you know, they're lighting it, it's lit very differently and it looks very different. And Sarah Helling's, who directed The Mark of the Rani, clearly she's really enjoyed going out on location. The performances are different on location as well, as you pointed out.
I think
maybe they're more naturalistic on location. It's just everything on location is very naturalistic. The light, the look, the performances, as much as, you know, Anthony Ainley and Kate O'Mara and Colin Baker are ever naturalistic, they're much more naturalistic out on location. The minute they get into the studio, it's much bigger, broader performances from some of them.
Again, like at the very end, the Rani and the Master stalking around the TARDIS console and kind of pushing each other. They're very broad, slightly comedic ways of doing that scene.
And yet, when they're out on location and they have scuffles, it looks much more subtle. Like when the Doctor bumps into the Master and pinches the Rani's brain juice outside Dingley Dell or whatever it's called, that's done very subtly. He kind of bumps into it and you kind of think, oh, the Sixth Doctor's just being a bit alpha male and kind of pushing past the Master to make a point. And it looks very, very natural. You can believe it from the performances.
And you mentioned the Dell. Having talked about a forest, because so much is on location, you know, you're actually in a proper wood. And so there's no question of going, oh, is this strange alien landscape just a few dodgy bits of plywood or whatever? It's supposed to be a wood, and it is a wood. That kind of thing alone lifts the production.
While we're talking about the kind of differences in performance, though, and some of the slightly more theatrical, shall we say, elements in studio, I mean, slightly undermine what we've just said now. And the most ridiculous thing is when the Rani's leading Perry out of Dingley Dell and they get to the last one of the tree mine things and the Rani says, can you jump without falling on your face? And it's like, well, she can, but why don't you just walk 5 centimetres around the mine rather than leap over it?
It's one of those problems where that's the line in the script and they haven't really set up, or they haven't been able to work out quite how to place a mine or find a spot where that really makes sense. And instead of going, let's not use this line then, because actually it's a nice line having the Rani just being rude to Perry, but you kind of go, it's just stepping over a mine. It's not giant. There's no massive gap in the earth or anything, it is just...
Why would you even go anywhere near it when there's a vast gap by the side?
Yeah, it's very odd. I don't know, although the Doctor goes hunting for mines to get himself out of the Dell afterwards, there's no indication that anyone actually goes and clears those mines at any point in the story. So presumably there are about 5 unexploded mines just sitting in that Dell waiting for unsuspecting Luddites or just local denizens to wander through. While we're on the Dell, of course, for all that I think, overall there's quite good quality production. The tree is obviously one of those problems in the story. The actual transformation effect, when the people stand on the mines and turn into trees, I think works really well. When they're carrying Colin along and suddenly turn into 2 trees and he's still there hanging between them, that effect is really good, and it's really good when it happens to Luke. Unfortunately, the script then requires the tree to move. And so you get this just unintentionally hilarious moment where the branch moves to protect Perry. And, you know, it's touching because Luke is rescuing her, but you don't really notice that because you're too busy laughing at a ridiculous... Either he's turned into a tree or he isn't turned into a tree. And I know, you know, maybe he hasn't quite permanently become a tree yet because it's only just happened, but it just looks silly. And the line, "the tree won't hurt you," is rightly ridiculed.
It is rightly ridiculed. Although the most irritating part of the whole exchange isn't for me that. It's when the Doctor, a couple of moments later, says to Rani, "Now will you admit that there's more things in heaven or earth?" And I hate that quote anyway because it's just ridiculously overused. And I particularly hate
from it. From the character Bible that says, by the way, he likes quoting Dickens or Shakespeare or, yeah, or whatever.
But yeah, I found that particularly galling and a stupid line. I wish they'd just had him turn into a tree and then not move.
That's what they should have done. They should have just been... silliness. Yes, it's nicely touching that the character's kind of redeemed trying to save Perry. But the character was never evil in the first place. It was only the horrible mind maggots that did it. I think the mind maggots are one of those things. I wonder whether the story just... I mean, it has lots of ideas in it. I wonder if it has too many ideas that actually it's trying to pack in brain fluids being stolen, mind maggots controlling people, the Master's plot with the geniuses, the Rani's plot with Mia Samir Gorya, George Stevenson developing the rocket, the general Luddite type stuff. It's teeming with things. I just wonder whether there's so many of them, they slightly start to overpower each other.
I'm not entirely sure that Pip and Jane are quite clear on what the script's about, because at the start... there's an exchange as the Doctor and Perry are walking into the village where they talk about the hedges, and Perry makes a point that those hedges don't exist in the 20th century. They're all removed to make bigger fields and industrialised farming, and lots of animals have become extinct as a result.
From the small note somewhere that Perry's supposed to be a botanist.
But I thought that was maybe setting up a theme that actually unfettered progress and
industrialisation
of science without morality are... terrible, because actually things die, and if there's no morality and science isn't practiced for the good of humanity, it's a terrible thing. And the Rani kind of typifies that. She thinks people are pointless other than as sources for her experiments. So I think there's a kind of point that they fix on here that science can be a terrible thing. And I think it's something they come back to in their Vervoid story, where Professor Lasky's very Rani-ish and will do anything for her Demeter seeds,
And they touch on, just when the Doctor, for some reason, decides that they're not really proper Luddites, they kind of mention the Luddites, and they mention the reason why the Luddites were concerned about industrialisation. But then the story doesn't do anything with it. Its message is pretty much, George Stevenson is brilliant, hooray,
exactly,
hooray, industry.
And that's where it's as though it's setting up this theme that maybe something's lost through industrialisation and science, and then it ends up celebrating. It finishes with George Stevenson making his new valve and the Doctor getting excited about the rocket, and it kind of never resolves. Why is Stevenson good and the Rani bad? And it never really gets to the heart that Stevenson's presumably, in Pip and Jane's mind, doing it for the benefit of humankind.
Even, you just need Stevenson saying something like, you know, I'm interested in the science for itself, but also if this machine works, we'll be able to transport food from place to place or whatever, you know,
we'll
boost economies.
These mines so much safer and people won't die and etc. You needed, I think, something like that to show why the Doctor would instinctively side with George Stevenson versus the Rani, because they're both scientists.
And the Rani's approach is really interesting. The Doctor doesn't really argue against it, he just says it's wrong. When she kind of says, well, humans eat lesser creatures, they're carnivores, so she's taking it as read that she and the Doctor as Time Lords are greater creatures than humans, so why on earth shouldn't she treat humans like humans treat animals? And obviously there's a lot, you know, there's stuff to do with sentience and all the rest, but the Doctor doesn't make that argument. The Doctor just goes, well, that shows what you're like, doesn't it? And it doesn't really actually tackle what is quite an interesting question. Why should she not look down on humans the way she would look down on any other lesser species?
So while we're on the subject of the Rani, what do you think about the Rani?
She's kind of fun. I'm not really sure that there was much point creating her. I think in a way she's kind of been introduced as a female master, and that's understandable because I think, as everyone accepts, Time Lords can't change gender. So the Master can never be a woman. And so it's interesting, you're saying, well, we want a female Time Lord villain. The trouble is, she starts off as, you know, quite different from the Master. And actually, although it's odd putting the Master then in the story, it gives her someone to spar with before she encounters the Doctor.
Mm.
And it helps, I think, delineate between their two characters. If the Master wasn't in it, it would be easier for her to be more like the Master. But because the Master is in it, it helps show the difference between them. And the Master's quite a bully, and has these big schemes. The Rani is much more focused on the science and kind of lacking ethics rather than being actively evil, albeit in the background apparently she's ruling a planet.
Pip and Jane do seem to have this real thing about immoral women. I think it's very well known they're Labour Party
that's
activists.
That's just about their home life.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. It's a Thatcher allegory.
And I think, you know, there's this thing about heartless, cruel women that runs through all of the stories that they wrote. Obviously, the Rani's back again in Time of the Rani, but I think Professor Lasky...
I think in Time of the Rani, she's actually got the idea for getting the geniuses together from the Master's throwaway comment in this story.
But Professor Lasky is written practically as the Rani, and they get Honor Blackman, who, let's face it, is as camp an icon as Kate O'Mara. Kate O'Rani. I don't know, I think she's different enough from the Master to make that double act kind of work, because they both dislike the Doctor, but for different reasons.
Mm. She's more worthwhile in this story than Time, partly because in Time of the Rani she becomes more like a female Master, but in this she's more of a distinct character with her own agenda.
I can see why Ainley would feel threatened by the character, because actually she comes across as being, in a lot of ways, more capable than the Master.
Yeah.
I hesitate to say superior, because every turn, although she's shown as mentally superior, she's outwitted by the Master. He has a hold on her right from the first scene, and at the end he kind of throws her aside from the controls, like, oh, you stupid woman driver, let a man have the...
Well, she does it to him controls, and then he does it to her. I mean, it's quite balanced. But it is quite balanced. It's not one than the other. And she, you know, they're both tricked in different ways by each other. They're both tricked by the Master. Or she tries to be clever with her coughing pills, but then he realises it's coming.
Yeah.
But then that nicely sets up later on when she does it to Perry, and the Master plays along, knowing exactly what she's up to.
Okay.
And it helps make them both look smart, actually.
It does.
But yeah, I think that it's interesting the way the Master kind of bullies her in that scene, where he's quite like a schoolyard bully.
Yeah.
Just like grabbing her stuff and not letting her get it.
So I think you're probably right in that they are balanced, but I certainly don't think that the Master comes off really badly compared to the Rani. I think it is very much a relationship of equals. I was kind of watching it, and I've thought before, there's no reason why the Rani needs to be a Time Lord.
No.
It's a shame she's not just Nick, the Master's TARDIS, or she's the Master's ex-companion. The Master's ex-companion, who's got tired of his obsession with wanting to kill the Doctor, and she just wants to rule stuff.
Yeah.
He's been following her for some reason. It's never quite clear why he's been stalking her.
He's gone to Maestro Meagoria and followed her. She, meanwhile, has been like reading the novelisations and keeping up to date with what the Master's been doing.
Well, I guess there's a space-time telegraph that they read.
They're plugged into the Matrix or something.
Because the Master knows all about her exile from Gallifrey, so unless it happened hundreds of years ago when he and the Doctor first left.
I mean, it's problematic, isn't it? Because the Time Lords aren't supposed to want random renegades wandering around.
Not with TARDIS.
So they gave the Rani a TARDIS and told her not to come back. And I think that's, one of the problems with her being a Time Lord. Obviously, we've had the Monk in the past and got Drax. We've met Asmael only a few stories back as well. And it starts to give the impression there's just Time Lords littered around the galaxy, rather than the Master and the Doctor being rather special cases. Particularly when she's flying around in the TARDIS doing the same kind of thing as the Master as well. But she is fun, and I think Kate O'Mara's very good. I think she and Ainley play off each other very well. And the scenes with Perry, they all work very well together. Yeah. So I think in this story, she's quite interesting. And even like at the beginning, that other thing that's quite Masterish, her being in disguise. You know, the Master, who famously disguises himself, is, for no apparent reason, dressed as a... I mean, if he kind of just hide around the corner from the TARDIS if he wants to, actually standing in the middle of a field dressed as a scarecrow is quite ridiculous. Meanwhile, she's dressed as an old crone with an old latex crone mask. No one knows who she is on Earth. She doesn't need to disguise her face. She could just be a young woman running a bathhouse.
It's kind of bizarre. I think the Rani's plan is at least articulated. Her plan is she needs to get this brain fluid to regain control of her planet.
Hmm.
So you can kind of get that. I still don't know what the Master's plan is, and I've watched, I can't remember how many times I've watched The Mark of the Rani.
Very unclear.
Why has he got all of the all the geniuses gathering anyway, or has he engineered that meeting?
Yeah, apparently he hasn't. It's just a coincidence that it's happening. But now that he's found out it's happening, he wants to use it. But then he's gone there, at the beginning, he says he's gone there to kill the Doctor, but that isn't his main plan.
But he's followed the Rani there.
Yeah.
So did he follow the Rani there first, and then think, oh, the Rani's here, I'll get the Doctor here as well. Ooh, and there's some geniuses all gathering. The whole thing relies on a bizarre web of intrigue and mayhem.
I don't know whether he's making it up as he goes along. Maybe he's just feeling a bit lonely, and he's like, do you know what, I'm going to hang out with the Rani and the Doctor whether they like it or not, and I'll pretend I've got some scheme going on. I'll try and kill the Doctor at some point.
There's more Time Lords on Earth than there are on Gallifrey at this point.
Maybe the Master just wants to show off all his new devices he's been building for himself. You can understand why in the current series the sonic screwdriver does everything, because the Master's carrying around a sonic lance to kind of burn through things, and then he's got a box that will open wooden doors, and he's got his tissue compression eliminator sex toy, which is, it looks even worse when Perry and the Doctor are holding it and just kind of waving it around suggestively. But yeah, he's carrying at least three different implements, probably plus his mobile phone and his work BlackBerry. You can understand why the Doctor does everything with a sonic.
Absolutely.
And yet, any of the Master's pockets bulging? Or is he just pleased to see you? I think Amy is good in it, and even if he felt threatened by the character of the Rani, actually he does keep up with her quite happily. I think Anthony is quite good, and on the whole does what he's asked to do, and it's not where he is maybe a bit over the top at times, it's because that's what how the character's been written, and it's an issue with the Master's character more than with his performance. We don't see the Master's TARDIS. We assume the Master has a TARDIS there, and that's how he's got there. We do see the Rani's TARDIS, and it's very nice. I think it's got, I like the little outdoor bit with the lights when she dematerialises, and it's got a nice, you know, it's not just the actual TARDIS, the Doctor's TARDIS redressed inside. It is a different console, isn't it?
Mm.
And a different set. It's maybe a slightly lazy resolution to the story that the Doctor has just fiddled with their TARDIS, and just the Rani's TARDIS just has to get them in it. But at least it's done earlier, at least he's in there earlier and it's kind of set up.
Yeah, and he's done that many times, for instance, the Meddling Monk, he's done it before to the Master as well, so it's kind of his modus operandi.
I'd say, I don't know whether that justifies it as a recurring thing or just makes it feel even more lazy if it's actually what he's done several times before.
Yeah. The only other thing that I wanted to mention, it was at one point I got very confused because it was as though the Rani was implying that the Doctor... No, it was no longer able to regenerate.
Oh yeah, she slags off his face and then says, well, no, I can change mine, you can't. Like, well, is it that you're better at regenerating and so you can choose your face? Is it that you've just got quite a good line in latex old woman masks and you can look however you want? Yeah. Or are you genuinely saying that the Doctor can't regenerate?
Which would be...
It makes no sense.
Well, it makes no sense unless this much mythologised Master plan for... the Sixth Doctor actually involved the fact that he couldn't regenerate, or he was the last incarnation or something like that, because he was supposed to be the Doctor for a very long time originally and start off quite angry and dark and mellow, and there was something about he was going to have to destroy Gallifrey in the future.
Same with Master Plan.
Yeah. But I don't know, it just struck me as a very jarringly strange line, because the Doctor, if there's one thing that at that point in the series we knew, was that he could change his face. I mean, over the last 2 years we've seen every previous incarnation of the Doctor.
I wonder if it's intended as a bit of a and much more than a Time Lord kind of teaser line, or whether actually it's just, you know, it's a line that Pip and Jane wrote, not didn't really mean it like that and meant it in some other way, but it's slightly baffling now.
I suppose it's just a fumbled line that has no real thought behind it, but and it's probably to do with the fact that she's got latex masks, but it just seemed really strange when I was watching it.
It's an excellent disguise, though. She looks like a older Kate O'Mara. Brilliant disguise there. Well, I enjoyed that more than I expected to. And yeah, I think we chose wisely.
I think so. I think that is by far the best story for Colin Baker. I don't think it's necessarily the best Sixth Doctor era script, but I think it's the one that shows the Sixth Doctor in the best light and gives Colin Baker a chance to be whimsical and likeable and moral and to do the right thing. All the way through, he's looking to do the right thing. He's clearly torn. He refuses to take a gun for the first time, whenever he's had the chance to have a weapon in this incarnation before, he's grabbed it with both hands. And he actually says, oh no, I've given guns up, they're seriously bad for your health. He clearly is very morally torn about, well, what do I do? I can't have the Rani and the Master wandering about, but I need to stop those murderous Luddites from turning into trees.
Which he completely fails to do.
Which he fails to do, but he does the right thing.
Yes, yeah.
All the way through, I think he's shown to be in the right and shown in a very positive light. And I think that's very different from the way pretty much every other script in this series treats him. And I think if we'd had more Mark of the Rani's and Few Vengeance on Varos, season 22 would be much more highly regarded. And I think the Sixth Doctor might be much more highly regarded.
So would you say the way that the stuff in Mark of the Rani came together was quite lucky?
Fortuitous would be a more apposite epithet.
Oh, Pip and Jane, endlessly quotable. Well, that was the Mark of the Rani, and that is the end of the Sixth Doctor for us. We have done...
Well not necessarily.
Unless we choose the Twin Dilemma in season 21. So that is the end of the Sixth Doctor for us. But we still haven't had the Fifth Doctor at all, and we have plenty of other seasons still to taste. So let's ask the randomizer where we're going next.
I think it's going to be the Fifth Doctor this time.
Here we go. I know your money is on the Fifth Doctor.
Is the randomizer malfunctioning again, Will?
Malfunctioning? Malfunctioning? Malfunctioning!
Don't hit me!
We'll discuss this later. No, the randomizer is working perfectly and has selected the next season we will be tasting.
Lovely. My tongue's already hanging out in anticipation.
In anticipation. And it is The Key to Time, season 16. So, six stories for six segments.
Yeah.
The Rebos Operation, The Pirate Planet, The Stones of Blood, The Androids of Tara, The Power of Coal, and The Armageddon Factor. Your birthday story.
I was born on the same day of episode 5 of The Armageddon Factor. It was broadcast, so Drax is indeed my Time Lord.
And by coincidence, I was born on the wagon of a travelling show. episode 4. Right, well, there's some stories we've seen quite a lot.
I think this is Graham Williams' most consistent season. I think most of the stories are average, above average, ranging to very good. So I think the Rebos Operation's a very good, very fun way to start the Key to Time season. The Pirate Planet's got lots of good Douglas Adams things to enjoy. The Androids of Tara is summary and charming, as the Discontinuity Guide, I think, describes it. The Power of Kroll isn't that good, but it is by no means an underworld or an invisible enemy. It's competently done, it's just not great. And I think the Armageddon Factor, similarly, it's no masterpiece, but I think there's lots to like about the Armageddon Factor, particularly that it's the last six-parter that they ever did, and it's almost like the only three-parter they've done in the modern series where it's three kind of 50-minute chunks. It's three very distinct pairs of episodes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, yes.
Each has a different kind of focus and location. Mm-hmm. And so those five, I think, are all good. My favourite, and one of my very favourite stories of all, is The Stones of Blood, because I think it encapsulates the whole of the Tom Baker era better than any other Tom Baker story. So it starts off in kind of Hinchcliffe gothic horror, and then it goes for Graham Williams space opera. It's got some beautiful kind of 70s horror motifs in it, but it's also got some really broad Douglas Adams type comedy. It's a very funny and also very scary story.
Having summarised the season, is that moving you any closer towards which one we should watch?
The Stones of Blood, because it's a very scary and also a very funny story, and I'd like to watch it.
Okay. Well, The Pirate Planet is the one I've seen the most recently. The Stones of Blood is the one I've seen the most. The Power Crawl, I think, is the weakest one, and I don't really want to watch that one. And The Armageddon Factor is the longest one, and so I was just not watching that one. I'm inclined to say I like The Android Tatara, because it's by much of some sections of fandom very well regarded, and higher than The Stones of Blood, even. And actually, the Rebus operation I haven't seen for ages. And we saw Unstoff at the BFI last week, the week before. So I'd be quite tempted to watch that again. I think there's lots of nice things in there that I've kind of forgotten about.
Let's watch the Androids of Tara then, because I've watched the Rebus operation much more recently than any of the others. So out of the two you want to watch, I'd be much more up for the Androids of Tara.
I'm happy enough with any of those four, but I think I'm more interested in those two because I've seen them less, I think.
Okay, should we do Tara then?
Okay, simple enough. So yes, we'll watch the Androids of Tara and we'll let you know what we think next time.
Stay tuned.
Bye.
Bye. Is the randomizer malfunctioning again, Will?
Fortuitous would be a more apposite bit. No, that wasn't what you were setting up, was it?